Hello, boys and girls of Credit Union Land, and welcome to episode 59 of the CU Insight Experience. This episode is brought to you by our friends at Co-op Financial Services. Co-op is your trusted payments processing partner whose mission it is to drive the credit union movement forward, and we could not be happier to have them as a sponsor of the podcast. My name is Randy Smith. I am one of the co-founders of CUinsight.com, and it is my job on the show to have conversations with the best and the brightest of the credit union community. I get to pick their brains and see if we can't find a few nuggets that we can all learn from. My guest on today's show is Anthony Hernandez. Tony is the president and CEO of the Defense Credit Union Council. In doing research for this episode and our conversation on the old interwebs, I knew the leadership questions were going to be amazing. Before joining the credit union movement, Tony spent 25 years in the Air Force, retiring as a colonel. You talk about someone who's led a lot of people over his career. We talked about what makes DCUC special, and I personally learned a lot about how military credit unions serve the men and women who serve our country, and also the work they're doing and that's being done with for our veterans. Then we got into the leadership and life hacks. Like I said, this was a section I was pretty excited about. It did not disappoint. Tony had a lot to share that I'm sure you're going to be able to take something from. I thought his tips for the internal candidate trying to move up the ranks. Maybe you want to be the next CEO of your credit union. We're great. And, you know, it comes from direct experience over his career. So without further ado, I give you my conversation with Mr. Anthony Hernandez. Enjoy. Tony, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Randy. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm really looking forward to our chat.
You know, I was looking forward to it, too, doing my homework for our conversation on the old interwebs. That I knew there was going to be a lot we can talk about, not only leading the Defense Credit Union Council, but your background in the military. I'm like, we're going to have a ton to talk about in that leadership section as well, I'm sure. So this should be a ton of fun. I'd like to start with a broad question, and it's about a community article that you recently wrote for CU Insight about the Defense Credit Union difference, and I'll link to that article in the show notes, because if people didn't check it out, they should really read it. It was, it educated me. What makes defense credit unions so unique in the financial services space? And you know, the kind of follow-up secondary question, why are they so important for the men and women who serve our country?
Yeah, sure. Well, no, I appreciate the question, because, you know, defense credit unions, first of all, are like, you know, all the credit unions across the United States. The place where they go different is they specialize in serving our nation's military. All our current DCUC members are actually located on the installation.
Okay.
You know, and it goes a little bit further than just brick and mortar. I mean, they have to have an exclusive license in order to operate on that installation. You know, and that's because DOD can't legally provide financial services and products. And as such, you know, DOD have several regulators now, depending on their size. I mean, they got state regulators, they got the NCUA, some have CFPB, depending on their asset size, and then they actually have a Department of Defense. And they do all these things. They provide financial readiness training for our members. And then there's two essential functions that they provide that's unique to defense credit unions. And one is what I like to call expeditionary cash. And that's any time that a military unit is going to deploy or support a contingency operation. You know, I was a finance officer in the Air Force, and every execution order had a four-hour time limit to get everything together. And they usually started at $50,000 increments, right, all the way up to $1 million, if depending on the size of the mission we were supporting. Well, military comptroller squadrons and finance battalions, they don't keep cash in their vaults anymore. They go and hit the local credit union or the financial institution on the base. And so we'll go hit up every ATM, you know, go to the vault and deliver that cash in 4 hours. And, you know, if they didn't have these operating agreements with credit unions, they'd have to contract with a bank downtown or another credit union downtown that doesn't understand the mission, doesn't understand the need for operational security, and can't really marshal that much money at moment's notice. And so we do that. And then the last thing that they do is they deposit the government's daily cash. So, you know, when the commissary does their end of day receipts or the child development center or the dining facility, they don't take all those receipts and that cash over to the finance battalion. They actually have to go to a depository institution that manages a Treasury General account each day for the government. And so we provide those services for free. I mean, in some cases, it's $1 million of expeditionary cash, and it's a ton of receipts from different organizations on the base. We provide those to DOD for free. And that's sort of the credit union difference. In addition to quality checking accounts, savings accounts, great rates on loans, and great rates on all the other stuff that credit unions do, we really make our difference. And there's that whole community support. You know, if it's the Air Force ball or if it's the Marine Corps marathon or whatever, I mean, they come to our credit unions first to support that community.
So is this going on all over the world, like at U.S. bases?
Yeah, yep, absolutely. There's over 240 military installations worldwide, and we operate on every single one of them.
Oh, that's, you know? That's
and
awesome.
Then you asked a question, Randy, about, you know, why is this important to the men and women who serve our country?
Yeah.
We are getting ready to debut a live action video that sort of explains our role, not just on the base, but in the communities that we serve. And if you don't mind, I'd like to read, you know, some of the script from that, because I found the script very compelling. This just, we're in design and production on this thing right now.
I'd love to hear it. And also, if by the time this goes live, if the video is out, we'll have to embed it in the show notes as well, so everybody can check it
out. Absolutely.
So.
It'll be ready about in about a week.
Understand. Then we will have it. That's awesome.
Well, here's a script, and it starts like this. Military life is like no other. It's fight and flight. It's putting down roots that reach far and wide into something bigger than a place. We were started almost 60 years ago by people just like you. So we understand the challenges and the dreams, because military life is still real life. And deep down, we're all people. We get married, we buy houses, we have kids and grandkids, and eventually we retire. Our members fight hard for a better life, a better country, a better tomorrow. And so we're here to fight for them, to help them grow, realize their dreams, and grab their slice of the American pie. Because in the end, it's not about money, it's about life, family, and community. Something we're all a part of. That's why we do what we do. And that's the DCUC difference.
Oh, that is awesome. And you gave me chills.
That's fantastic. I can't wait to see the video.
Oh, no. Yeah. I'm sure everybody who's listening is going to want to watch it. So we will make sure to embed that as well. I wanted to move on to, you know, kind of credit unions overall, but just to keep it and then kind of bring it back down to the defense credit unions. Every credit union is facing issues, you know, whether it's regulation. You mentioned it sounds like the defense credit unions have quite a few bodies to answer to. You know, finding good talent, disruption, the pace of change in financial services. Are there issues specific to defense credit unions that your organization prioritizes?
Yeah, you know, every year it seems like we're fighting this perennial, battle on the National Defense Authorization Act, competing with the bank lobby. They feel they're entitled to no-cost land leases and a waiver on all the logistical costs, you know, picking up sewage, refuse, mowing the lawn. You know, if you're in a federal facility and you're a not-for-profit credit union, you get those services for free.
Okay.
You know, banks have to pay because they're a for-profit, so we fight that every year. But some of the things that we prioritize a lot is really getting DOD to enforce their own regulations. You know, we sign exclusive agreements, and we agree to provide all this stuff for free. And in return, DOD has a set of considerations that they give to the credit union that's on the base. And so, you know, with turnover every 2 years on a military installation, we get people that don't even read the regulations anymore. And so we have to explain to them, here's a black and white text of what you have to do. And the biggest one is in the one bank, one credit union policy. And that means, hey, I want to get exclusive rights to the installation and to do newcomers orientation or to conduct financial readiness training to handle the TGA account. But what we see is a lot of incursions because people like to go get commercial sponsorships and they'll invite another bank onto the base that doesn't have to do all that stuff for free. And so we really try to police that a lot. They can come on the base and donate money, but they can't advertise. They can't put out financial forums and compete with the credit unions on the base. And then we have some people that still try to charge rent, still try to charge logistical costs. So we police that. You know, working with the military exchange service, there's a lot of incursions that occur through that. Military exchange is like a target on the base.
You okay.
can get a lot of different things from the military exchange. And so they even have their own credit card now that's not backed by a bank or a credit union. It's in-store credit. When you enlist in the military, they hand you their star card and say, go buy your uniforms on credit. My complaint is that competes with our credit unions that are on the base. And I asked a very difficult question and got a not so good answer from very senior DOD people that, you know, we have to comply with the Military Lending Act. In fact, all credit unions have to comply with that. Where are the military exchange services? How come they don't have to comply? Right. The DOD wrote the regulation. And so they kind of go, what do you mean? I go, look, we have to hire our member credit unions, and credit unions all across the country have to hire compliance staff to make sure that they can document, you know, how they're protecting the military from a 36% annual percentage rate.
Yep.
I don't see the same level of scrutiny from the exchange services. So we point that out a lot. And a lot of times the exchange services don't think the regulations apply to them. And it clearly says in the regulations they do. And so it seems kind of silly, but, you know, I fight the same battles every year. I guess it's job security, right?
Right. I was just going to say, yeah, it makes the job secure. And I mean, I could see that with, like you said, turnover in the bases and, you know, I mean, in administrations, right? So when you think about, and you're looking at credit unions overall, is there something that you think, and this is a question that I've asked, you know, through the first season and now into the two, that just credit unions in general need to fundamentally change to keep pace with, you know, all the disruption that's going on in financial services?
Yeah, that coming in as an outsider, you know, from the military, you know, and then spending, you know, the last 3.5 years inside the credit movement, you know, here at DCUC, just some things that I noticed. So this is kind of coming as an outsider and a pseudo insider, you know, right. As I go along. But, you know, the one thing I think that's going to fundamentally change to keep pace is that I think it's Generation X.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is baby boomers in the executive suites and boardrooms slowly retire. And man, it is a slow retirement. I'd say that, you know, hanging on to the status quo is probably hurting our industry in several ways. Our traditional service model is hands down the best. That's what makes credit unions strong. But I think an over-reliance on the traditional service model can be detrimental, especially if it comes at the expense of everything else. And so I think, you know, as people hang on all the way through that retirement, I don't think we've made some of the pivots that we would need to make as an industry moving forward. If decision makers know this outright, you know, then it's a shame because we're losing market positions when we could be doing better. And then the second thing is there's keeping pace with technology, which I believe is an outgrowth of hanging on to the status quo, you know, too long. You know, and while many of our credit unions are just now introducing mobile apps and better websites, which is great, but it's also so last decade, right?
It's table stakes at this point, yeah.
It's just going, hey, I'm proud of you, but what else? You know, so we're talking about artificial intelligence and, you know, machine language and how do we mine our data better and protect our members, you know, IoT interfaces, you know, how do we get involved with that or biometric banking products, peer-to-peer payments. And then there's something out there called empathic banking. You know, that one caught my attention. You know, how do we really, you know, drill down to taking care of our members' needs and some of their wants. And so there's a lot of good things out on the horizon, but I think with Gen X coming along, and there was a great article called Generation X, America's Neglected Middle Child. people focus on baby boomers and they focus on millennials. Well, who's this middle generation?
I'm 45 years old. I am part of that middle, you know, so it's we always laugh that we're never mentioned at a conference, right? Like we're just skipped right over.
Yeah, I think Gen X is a good bridge. You know,
absolutely.
Understand leadership models and, you know, traditional service models coming forward. But remember, our generation went through all the digital transformation.
Absolutely.
I remember going, you know, Walkman, that was pretty cool. VCR, and we've seen all these changes, and I think we're well, you know, this generation is well poised to have a tremendous impact on the future.
Well, I love hearing that, and I'm sure there'll be a few others who do. It's like, wait, Gen X was mentioned on a podcast? What? No. So anyway, hey, the last question in this first section, if we were to sit down a year from now, what are you most proud of that you and your organization have accomplished in the year to come, if you had to break out the crystal ball for me?
Yeah. Well, I think one thing we're working on is that, you know, I look to finally settle the perennial NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act battle with the bank lobby. And it's going to require not only a proactive approach, but also more of a, to use a football term, we need to stop playing defense on our side of the 50 and start taking the fight to them. You know, if credit unions and banks are supposed to be equal, then banks ought to start acting more like not-for-profit institutions and start making some decisions for banks. So we'll work on, you know, some of those things. We are looking to get traction or even passage of H.R. 2305. That's the Veteran Members Business Loan Act, and that typically excludes loans made to veterans from the member business lending caps. And there was a study a year ago by the New York Fed and the Small Business Administration that said there were more small business loans that were made, you know, with this economy going forward. But veterans were well below the rest of the population on that. And there were two reasons. One is because they move around a lot and can't establish credit histories. And two is because most commercial lending institutions don't make commercial loans or business loans below $100,000. This is where credit unions are at least helping veterans.
Yep.
This is a great way for them to do that. We're looking to amend the NCUA regulations to include the use of, I'll use a military acronym, APO and FPO. That's an Army Post Office and a Fleet Post Office, to use those addresses in qualifying for low-income credit union designation. So there's a large population of junior enlisted that are stationed overseas and using these APO, FPO addresses that don't get included in the 50% plus one threshold for getting that low-income credit union designation. And so we think that's going to be good. The other thing we're doing this year, Randy, is we're establishing our new military technology committee. I think I talked about some of those new things we're looking at, you know, biometric, IoT. The big thing with that is anybody asking questions for veterans, right? So, you know, if you're talking about biometric identification, what if you got injured in battle and your face is disfigured?
Yep.
What's the workaround? You know, if you're using peer-to-peer data in a social media environment, what happens if you don't have your phone with you because you're going into a classified area downrange? If you're talking Internet of Things, you know, when your refrigerator orders your milk and eggs automatically for you, what happens, you know, since there's not any movement in Congress to make merchants responsible for data security? What if the enemy hacks into the Westinghouse, the Maytag database, and a member of SEAL Team 6, we can predict when they're going to deploy because I look at the refrigerator data.
Yeah.
And so what kind of safeguards are we putting on those things? And so I'll be speaking at an event next week in Irvine, California I'll be speaking at a filing event, and that'll all be available later on to folks. But I'm just asking these questions, you know, is the juice worth the squeeze? You know, it costs a lot of money. Well, we have this ADA lawsuits going on now for Non-American with Disabilities Act websites, right? This is probably the next thing, because how are you taking care of your veterans?
Yeah.
So if defense credit unions aren't asking those questions, who else will?
Absolutely.
So that's what we're doing. And then I just want to increase our visibility, our membership, extend it to credit unions that aren't on bases, that have large military populations, some of the leagues and trade associations and the QSOs and tech providers. You know, let's pull them all under the defense credit union tent, because they all serve military, just like our traditional members do.
We hope to help you on that one too. So get that, spread the love and the message. So I'd like to move on to the second part of the show. As I mentioned in the beginning, I thought this would be a lot of fun with your background. So first of all, thank you for your 25 years of service in the Air Force. I greatly appreciate it, and I'm so looking forward to you coming on today. What inspired Colonel Hernandez to take the gig in credit unions? You mentioned you got the outsider coming in. First of all, you were the COO, the Defense Credit Union Council, where you came on in 2016, but then you became the president and CEO here a couple of years ago now. So what was the inspiration? What brought you here?
That's an interesting story. You know, first of all, you know, everyone in the military will eventually retire. I see colleagues that are still in that kind of look at me funny when I walk in a business suit. I'm like, you guys are going to be facing the same reality in about 2 or 3 years. You know, they force you out if you don't make the next rank. You know, and for a colonel, the maximum time on active duty is 30 years. So I got out at 25. And part of that calculus was, you know, after consulting with experts and former military leaders, a lot of people said, get out before you're 50, before age 50, because then you have time to start another career, maybe even become a CEO during that time. And, I had that advice. And so I took my qualifications as a highly rated military commander, which has a lot of the same, you know, competencies as a CEO. I was also a major command comptroller. In fact, at one point I was controlling a $20 billion annual budget.
I read that in your bio. Yeah.
And that's very much like a chief financial officer. And so I matched those to potential, you know, career opportunities. But here's a magic move, right? The one I foot stomp, which is a military term for pay attention, right? They say behind every great man there stands a great woman, right? And the truth to that statement can be seen not only throughout my military career, but also my transition to civilian life. And so my wife, Jennifer, worked for DCUC for 16 years.
Okay.
She was DCUC's original military spouse hire. I was Captain Hernandez stationed in the Pentagon. And so she stayed on board, changed her job title and her role, and it kind of grew over the years for 16 years. And, you know, during that time, I was fortunate to attend several DCUC events as her plus one.
You know, awesome.
But instead of sleeping in or playing golf, you know, I actually dressed up and attended the DCUC, you know, meetings and spent a great deal of time with its member CEOs and their boards of directors. You know, I had a mentor who always told me, you know, every day is your interview and take advantage of all this because you never know where your next job's going to come from.
Absolutely.
And so the whole thing, you know, working with my wife, you know, who would have thought, right? And CEOs in the room, you know, who would have thought? And so every time I spent some time around with the DCUC board of directors, because my wife was a board manager, you know, I always shook hands and got to know them. It also gave me an appreciation for the Defense Credit Union Council, which really helped during my CEO interview.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, you had some background there.
Yeah, and then it helped me structure the strategic plan, having been the COO for a year, and all those touch points, and I gave a huge credit to my wife. That's what made all the difference. And so what I really tell people, too, is never discount the contacts and the opportunities presented by your spouse, because you may be passing on a great second job or a second career. And I tell people that I'm living proof of that.
You know, Jill, my partner is also in credit unions, and I have, it's been fun to actually be the plus one at some events instead of the one who is working. People are like, are you covering? Nope. I'm a plus one. I'm just here to look pretty. I was interested to ask you this question. I mean, it is, you know, CEO is a different job than COO or other places in the organization since, you know, 2017 when you became the CEO. How has the inspiration or has the inspiration at all changed, you know, hanging your hat as the president and CEO of the organization?
No, I mean, the transition happened, you know, I was selected in April and became the CEO later on that August a year. So I'd kind of been on the job for about 7 months or eight months or so. And I always knew that the opportunity was coming up. So I started, you know, preparing myself for, you know, either I was going to take a shot at getting the CEO with no guarantees, but I was going to do the things. And I'd say the inspiration hasn't changed a whole lot. I mean, I still keep the hammer down. We're in the third year of our 5-year strategic plan, 2.5 years in right now, and we're still on track. And when I take time to reflect, you know, I can see where we made tremendous progress, and that just inspires me even more because we're starting to see the fruits of our labor, you know, moving forward. And that's what I like. What I like about this so far is that if I was a commander, it's only a 2-year assignment. I would have been transferred out already. Yeah.
Before you see the fruits of your labor, right? So
that's true.
Your answer just brought up a question to me. And if I remember correctly, it might have been Maria Martinez on an earlier episode talked about knowing that the CEO position was going to open up. And you mentioned that you were kind of preparing for that opportunity. Is there... there's a COO or a CFO out there and they're looking out and they're like, I know the CEO is leaving in a year. Any hacks or any tips that you have after going through that you would give somebody to prepare, make themselves known, I guess?
I would say, you know, understand the business. Try to understand, you know, you're going to be competing for the job. And so what's the best way that you can prepare so that they pick you? You know, it's personal relationships with the staff. It's understanding the mission, There's a couple of books I would recommend to folks. You know, we can discuss those in a bit. Yeah. But really, it's just developing an appreciation. And really, what I like about the credit union industry, it's all about relationships.
Yeah, I agree with
you. The military said, it's who you know. And that's just true, you know, and it's developing those relationships and being externally focused. Get out from behind the desk. Eat people.
It's such an interesting thing to me because a lot of the times you do see that where maybe the board wants to look outside, or can it just be a great advantage to be the internal candidate, right? Like, you know how you already have the institutional knowledge, right? So how would you describe your leadership style? And I wanted to throw on an add on to this too. Has that changed from military life to civilian life?
That's a great question. You know, there are so many different leadership styles. I studied a lot of these at the Air Command and Staff College, right? There's, depending on what book you're in, there's 7, there's 8, 10, 15 different leadership styles. And you start reading going, huh. I guess I would say, and this still applies, it applied in the latter half of my military career and carried over into my DCUC career. I'd say I'm highly adaptive.
Okay.
Right? And so I look at the different leadership styles more as a toolbox than a style, than an individual style, because you know, I believe that different situations or team compositions, whether you're in crisis management or, you know, growth mode or different organizational cultures, they all require an adaptive approach. And so sometimes you need, you know, the leader needs to get a little upset and get on a transactional basis.
Yep.
Sometimes if you're dealing with a strategic plan, you're more in you're trying to sell, you're more a transformational leader. You know, if I had to single one of those out and go, as my go-to, you know, my natural style, you know, kind of like hitting right-handed.
Right-handed switch hitter.
You know, I can hit left-handed. In fact, when I played soccer, I'm right-handed and right-footed. I actually scored more goals with my left foot.
No kidding.
Because I learned how to place the shot better, not just blast it. And so if I was to describe my go-to natural style, I'd say I'm more of a consensus builder.
Okay.
You know, and that's where the leader allows team members to work, you know, as a group and develop a solution collaboratively. And then they'll support whatever decision is made because I've listened to all the ideas. And as a leader, you kind of choose the best mix out of all those, and everybody's on board. And so I value honest dialogue, and I always fight for input from every member of the team. That way they have some stake in it.
You know, something that you mentioned earlier, but you just said that transformation, you said the latter half of your military career into now, did the changing of posts, I guess, every, like you've mentioned a couple of times, like every 2 years, you're kind of doing something new. Did that help? I mean, you had to work with a ton of different people over that career. So, yeah. I mean, broaden your approach. I could imagine you were a much different leader 25 years in than you were your first officer post or leadership post.
Well, you know, throughout my military career, I worked in 6 different major commands. And so, you know, when I'm working for fighter pilots, it's a different culture, and different rules of engagement. You work at a mobility base with cargo and tanker pilots. That's just completely different. Space guys are a different breed altogether. You know? I worked acquisitions. I worked overseas. You know, and then every unit has its own personality too, by individuals. And so you learn very quickly that to get along, you have to adapt to the tools that you have at hand. And so, yeah, I think it positioned me for this transition. And of course, the credit union landscape is changing a lot. You know, I mentioned Gen X taking over. That's going to drive a whole new trade association relationship with, long-term DCUC members that are now led by a different team.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how do we navigate that?
Is there something that your team at DCUC has heard you say so many times that they can finish your sentence?
Yeah. Well, remember I told you I like to hear ideas, right?
Yeah.
I try to keep it light. And so if I hear a really good idea, I'll listen and then I'll shake my head and I'll go, wait. And they know that now I have an idea.
Wait.
And I take credit for it. And they know I try to shed credit on them, you know. But it's just kind of a funny thing because that's when they know that it was a really good idea.
It stuck with you.
the other one, there's another one. You know, when I'm commenting on something or just pointing out the obvious, one of the things I'll always say is, in my humble but accurate opinion.
Humble but accurate.
And man, there's a ton of military, I'll just call military colloquialisms.
Yeah.
which are probably not suitable for this show.
We'd have to check a different box, right? The explicit box. So. I want to jump ahead a little bit here. Is there a myth as a leader, you know, like a leadership myth that you would just like to debunk? Like that does not make a good leader.
Yeah. You know, with leaders, I think sometimes people think the leader has to have all the answers, you know, and we can't do anything until the leader speaks. I would want to debunk that. And then the second thing is that the view from the top is free from stress. I think, the fact is much different. You know, most leaders I know are overwhelmed, overloaded, and overstressed. And usually if they have a lack of visibility or unapproachable, those are usually telling signs or indications that, you know, they are either, you know, overwhelmed, overloaded, overstressed. I think a lot of leaders just don't have an idea how to break out of that dilemma. And I'll recommend a book later on how to do that. But I think there's ways to bust out of that. And that's learn how to recast your stress, discover what you're feeling or what kind of emotion you're going through and figure out what, you know, where those emotions are coming from or what the meaning of are, and then explore opportunities that the situation presents, try to recast that in a different light, and then replace plans with possibilities, focus on people first, give, don't take, and then always demand the truth and always give the truth. So if you can just focus on those things, I think you'll find people get relaxed with you. You have a much better, leadership style.
Absolutely. Is there a lesson that, like, going to kind of put a couple of questions together here. Is there a mistake that you made, as a younger leader, or that you see young leaders make over and over again, and maybe give it context? How about that? That advice you would give, your 25-year-old self?
Yeah, there's lots of good advice, I guess, I would have. I guess the main thing I would tell folks, is figure out what your main thing is, right? Yeah. Finding your main thing. Have you ever seen the movie City Slickers, right?
it's been a while, but yes.
you had Curly trying to teach Mitch, right? And yep. He raises one finger and he goes, well, what's that? What's the secret to life? He goes, it's this. He goes, your finger raised? He goes, no, it's one thing. Once you figure out that one thing, everything else don't mean shit.
I love it. The clip.
But that goes along with something that I learned, was find out what your main thing is. And then the main thing is just to keep the main thing the main thing.
Yep.
Right? And doing everything you can to achieve that main thing is unquestionably the main thing. It sounds like circular logic, but it makes a lot of sense.
You say that, and the thing that comes to mind for me was getting older, I got much better at saying no. If it didn't fit into the, like what you're saying, the main thing, why am I doing this then?
So. If it doesn't fit along those lines of effort, you're wasting time. And that gets back to, another thing I tell them is get focus, narrow your focus. That'll give you a stronger intention for why you're doing things. And the stronger the intention, the greater likelihood you'll get what you want. And so, when people are crystal clear about what they're looking for, they'll find it everywhere. Don't read your press clippings. This goes for your entire career. Just keep working your plan. I always say, set the goal, create the plan, then forget the goal and work the plan. If it's a good plan, you'll get there, and you can reassess at different points. Find a mentor or someone else that can toot your horn. Don't do this on your own. And then there's a great book I'll recommend called The 48 Laws of Power. But there's a principle in there that says never try to outshine your boss. Yeah. And so for CFOs and CTOs and COOs that are looking, that's probably the biggest piece of advice I can give, is never try to outshine your boss, because that's the surest way to not get selected.
Yeah, to get bumped up, right? You mentioned mentors. Did you have a mentor, growing up? It was so... I enjoyed when this conversation would come up in the first season organically, so I added a question. So many of us have had great mentors who have helped us through. Is that something that there's someone that helped shape you into the leader you are today?
There were many, and each of them offered me a different piece of advice. First, credit to my mom and dad, Arnulfo and Mary Hernandez for, raising me, giving me a basic set of morals, feeding my ambition, and giving me a good sense of family. And my in-laws, Don and Joyce Power. Don was an engineer, called me the value of having an analytical mindset. Plus, he was a scratch golfer, and I haven't figured out how to do that.
As a chairman, I would have yet.
And my mother-in-law, how to accept people for who they are. In high school, I had three teachers. You know, two of them were student council advisors. You know, Mr. Warren Cupp and Ms. Donna McCoskey, and then my English teacher, Ms. Judy McKenzie, and they all taught me how to be a better person and believe in myself. And then in the military, you know, there were lots. You know, with Lieutenant Colonel Jeff Ingalls on how to plan and measure milestones. I had a retired Chief Master Sergeant named Bob Belchick. He taught me the importance of reading regulations, and not just the paragraph you're looking at. Read the chapter before and the chapter after, and now you understand the regulation. And that has saved my bacon, you know, more than any time at all.
I was going to say, that sounds like it's pretty relevant for the work you're doing today as well. So.
Yeah. There was a Brigadier General Sandra Gregory, and she taught me how to treat every day as my next interview. I had a wing commander. He was a colonel, and he rose up to 4-star. His name was General Robin Rand. He taught me leadership and command principles that have served me. I had a Colonel Mike Phelps, who's now working at the Department of Commerce. He was very hard, but he taught me the value of knowing the details. I'm not a details guy.
I'm with you.
I'm more of a big picture, but that'll save your bacon too. And then, you know, I had Major General Wayne Schatz and how to overcome leadership challenges, Lieutenant General Jerry Martinez and how to listen and build consensus. I had a 3-star, Lieutenant General William Rue, who taught me the fighter pilot mentality, even though I wasn't a fighter pilot, and then the emphasis on basics. And then, of course, a 4-star, General William Fraser, who taught me how to lead large organizations and the effect of orderliness. As far as the credit union, I'm just going to give a shout out to Dan Berger, who's been a great friend and a mentor for me in this new role, you know, demonstrating how to serve our members, our credit union members better. Plus, he has a great leadership blog, which I read and use a lot.
I am a huge fan of Dan and his blog, and you know, I think he was the third guest on the show. And not only his talk about, you know, extreme member service, but he also referred me to John Spence, who was on the show later, you know, just from that leadership perspective. So yeah, I'm a huge fan as well there. So I can see that. A couple of questions to wrap up this leadership and kind of life hack sections. You know, what does the, let's call it the typical Tony day look like?
Yeah.
and what does the perfect, you know, there's nothing on, and I'll say perfect outside of work, there's nothing on the calendar. I'm sure that doesn't happen a lot, but you know, what are you doing to, you know, unwind? What does work-life balance look like to you and your wife?
Okay. Yeah. Well, a typical work day, of course, you know, started in the military, it continues today. It's up early, you know, and up and at them. You know, I wake up about 3:45.
Do you really? Wow.
I brush my teeth, comb my hair, shave, get ready, and then I go work out. Before I get on, though, I usually, you know, unload the dishwasher, you know, clean up the kitchen. I like my wife being able to walk down to clean kitchen. It helps start my morning off right, too, if she doesn't have that stress environment.
That's awesome.
And then about 4:30, I'll either go to the gym or work out on we have a Peloton. I'll work out on that. And then, you know, between 5:30 and 7, it says, you know, it's running the dog outside, taking out the trash, watching the news. I'll post or comment on LinkedIn, clear out my emails and all that stuff. But I will focus on breakfast with the family at 7 a.m. and leave for work at 7:30. Now, I have a 20-minute drive to the metro station and a 50-minute metro ride, you know, one way. So it's an hour and 10 minutes one way. And
yep.
So I'll do some more work or answer some more emails. And then I work here till 5, take it back, you know, 50-minute back on the metro, 20-minute drive if there's no traffic. And then I'll eat dinner and spend time with my wife. We'll either open a bottle of wine, talk, or watch a movie. And at 9 p.m., I'll fall asleep.
I was just going to say, it has to be early.
Yeah, well, and then at midnight, I'll wake up off the couch and go to bed.
I do that often myself. I need to go back and listen to the episode that Tansley Stern was on, because I'm not sure which one of you two wake up the earliest. But she is also an early riser and a Peloton person, if I remember correctly. Nice. So it's
you asked me another question, though, in the perfect day. I mean, the perfect day at work is, you know, one or two appointments with lots of white space throughout the day. That white space is golden.
Well, you said you're kind of the strategic thinker. We need people like you and I need white space if we want to get our thoughts going. So,
outside of work, I guess, you know, I love to read with some, you know, especially in the early mornings on the weekends. It's quiet. Nobody else is up. I enjoy a great cigar and a glass of fine scotch, usually two fingers. you know, while sitting outside with my wife and she's drinking a nice bottle of wine, we watch the sunset and the stars come out, and that's just perfect for us. You know,
that's a perfect day. I am a Scotch guy myself. If you're a Scotch guy, I just watched a documentary on Netflix. It's the bourbon movie, but it's called Neat, and it was so interesting to me. So I'll shoot you a link to it if you haven't seen it yet. But it was a cool one. I'd like to get to the last part of the show, the rapid fire questions. The questions are rapid. Your answers don't have to be, so we can just have a little bit of fun. What was young Tony like in high school? You know, the first couple episodes of this, I took out part of this question, and I got a lot of feedback that people missed this, so I added it back in going forward. But do you remember the first time you got into memorable trouble?
Yeah. I mean, the answer to that, you know, when I talk about my high school, I was always been very competitive and driven. I always felt like I was going places. My mom and dad fueled my ambitions, you know, encouraged me. And so in high school, I was a consummate politician.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. I didn't belong to any clique, yet I had lots of friends in each of the cliques. So I could walk, you know, anywhere in the school, and I had friends in every one of the groups, which helped me get elected both class president and then student body president. You know, and I was on the state student council. I went to the national student council convention, you know, American Legion All-State, Junior Rotarian, you know, all this stuff. I was in the honor society, team captain in soccer, and all-state honors, for having a lot of assists, marching band, jazz band. And so, you know, my high school persona was, I am not going to mess this up, because, you know, I was scared to get in trouble.
Okay.
I didn't take my teenager risk, right? But I guess memorable trouble. I mean, I remember made my dad really, really upset with me, because I was out joyriding in my car. And in high school, I had a 1979 Ford Mustang.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, not the fast one, Randy.
Oh, the 70s one, right. Okay. Yeah.
but it had a sunroof, so it looked cool.
I was going to say, it looked cooler in my 78 Dodge Aspen, that's for sure. So
I was out, you know, we lived out in the, you know, I grew up in New Mexico, and I was out in the desert, you know, driving my car. Well, I'll just say I was driving very fast up and down some hills, and I made a turn and got my car high centered on a sand dune. And this was on New Year's Eve. We had all kinds of plans that evening. We had to go. I had to walk all the way back home to explain to my parents. And we had to go out there and try to dig out the car. And yeah, I got into some trouble for it.
That didn't go. I've been asking the question that, like, most of us stumbled into credit unions in one way or the other. And I mean, you mentioned your path to them earlier, but I want to take you way back again. What did you want to be when you grew up? You said you were a politician in high school. Were you going to be the next president, or what's the?
Yeah, everyone has that dream, you know, or a senator or a governor. You know, so I always had that, you know, doing whatever I could to qualify me for that, whether I got there. You know, I always felt that you shoot for the stars, and if you end up closer to them, well, then you're closer than you would have been had you not. And so that was always driving me. But you know, that's one reason why I became an officer in the military, because I looked at the military path, and I never intended to make it a career. It was always supposed to be a four years out.
Then another four, right?
Yeah. And then, well, you never quit on the same day. I got married. We had kids. You know, the military life is very good, you know, when you're in it. They take care of all your needs. And so my wife didn't want to quit when I wanted to get out. When she wanted to get out, my career was taking off, you know. So when you both decide you want to retire on the same day, that's when you push the proverbial button and you apply for retirement. And here I am.
That was the day. You kind of mentioned what your mornings start, you know, you wake up early and what you do. Is there one thing that you do that if like you don't do in the morning or each day, your day just feels off?
Yeah, I think that'd be workout, because if I don't do it in the morning, I don't do it at all. I always find an excuse. There's always an excuse not to work out.
Trust me, I know that.
I use a lot of them. But yeah, that kind of throws me off the rest of the day, because then I feel, you know, that was easy to do. You could have got, you know, why'd you sleep in till 4:30 in the morning?
Sleep until 4:30. So great. I thought I was an early riser at 5:36, but man, that's awesome. Is there an app or a tool that you just couldn't live without?
No, not really. I mean, I like using apps, but, you know, my military career, some of the classified assignments that I had, I wasn't allowed to take advantage of new technology. And so, you know, I had to lock up my my smartphone and my smartwatch, you know, my iPad. I had a LiveScribe smart pen that I thought was really cool. but I had to leave all those things at the door or disable them when I came into the they call it a SCIF. It's a secure compartmented facility that you come in, you badge in, and, you know, not quite as bad as Maxwell Smart and, you know, and Get Smart. Right. You still go through a series of doors to get in there. And so I sort of missed the technology waves and or adapted to whatever, you know, either low tech system or no tech system, like a paper journal. I use a Franklin planner.
Okay. Still use the planner. Yep.
Yeah. And I still use those today. So I sort of missed all that. You know, what was kind of sad about that, you know, the military, for all its emphasis on exploiting technology and being the leader in that, sure doesn't do that for its members.
Right, I mean, for the, yeah.
Has anybody seen Millbook? It's like the military's Facebook.
Millbook. Awesome. The random question, what's the best album of all time? That one you can listen to without skipping a song.
Wow. You know, when I was in high school, I would listen to Mannheim Steamrollers Fresh Air.
Okay. Yeah.
And there were several. I think 4 was my favorite until I listened to 5. And I went back and listened to 3. So I'd say maybe the set was Fresh Air, you know, 1 through 8.
Okay. We won't link to it.
But the reason I liked it was it helped me decompress.
Okay.
It helped me reflect and focus. And I always shut my eyes and imagined myself living in the future. You know, and I kind of took this, sounds morbid, it was kind of like looking back on my life from my deathbed, right? And that kind of gave me that escapism, you know, and I kind of think that reason why I'm here today was a lot of that visualization that occurred.
Okay.
Listen, and that sounds kind of weird, but today I don't really have a single album. I think it's more of a compilation on Spotify.
Yeah.
I love listening to yacht rock, which is mostly 70s hits.
That was always back when we had a CU Insight office and like the speaker in the middle. Yacht rock was always a favorite that made an appearance at least like once a week. So I know what you're talking about.
I like listening to 80s hits. It takes me back to high school without the parachute pants.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And then when I'm in the car, you know, I'll listen to SiriusXM's, you know, Hair Nation. And, I like listening for rock ballads and some headbanging anthems and stuff. So all the above, I guess, is a better answer.
When I was a guest on my own show, it was Guns N' Roses' Appetite for Destruction. So yeah. I get the hair ballad or the hair bands. So I'm a reader, as you know, I've mentioned on every show. Jill and I have this stack of books that we keep trying to make our way through. You've mentioned that you had a few books on your mind while we've been talking today. So my guess is you're going to add to our list. Do you have any books that either you've gifted to other people or that you just think everybody should read?
Yeah, I've done both. You know, I think you and I were trading emails. You mentioned Sundoku, and I was like, I had to look it up. Yep. You know? And I have a lot of books, but it doesn't look as bad as the images.
Right, the image is there. We're not that bad either. But yeah, it's that the idea of owning books that you're going still to read someday. I you know, it's funny, Tony. I just read an article and I showed it to Jill because I was like, look, I'm not crazy. But it actually said that having books that you may never get to, it makes your mind think just by looking at them like, oh, I still need to read that one. So I'm like, see, it's all right if I'm buying books that we still haven't read and buying more. So,
but I guess to answer your question, Randy, I mean, I still circulate a starter list for new leaders. I mean, I sort of developed this for commanders that as a full colonel in the Air Force, I had lieutenant colonels and majors who were also squadron level commanders that worked for me. And so I always had a list of books that said, welcome to command. Here's your starter list to go read. And the very first book I got in there was recommended to me by my wing commander. He rose up to 2 stars. His name was Wayne Schatz. And the book was called Leader Shock and How to Triumph Over It. And they posed 8 revolutionary rules for becoming a powerful and exhilarated leader. You know, the premise of the book was the term leader shock refers to the reality leaders face in being overwhelmed, overloaded, and overstressed. And so he had a lot of great 8 rules. I talked about a couple of them earlier about recasting your stress and give and don't take, demand the truth. But the most powerful idea he had in his book was how to activate your intentions. And that kind of gets back to be clear on what you want,
yep,
you know, and speak it. And then, you know, he had to refuse to conform and own it all. So I always thought that was a good book. The other book I recommend, Leader Shock, was written by Greg Hicks in 2004. I'll include the links, send them to you. The other book was written in 1992 by Deborah A. Benton. And this book was called Lions Don't Need to Roar.
Okay. I've not read that book, but I've heard of that book. So
it's using the leadership power of personal presence to stand out, fit in, and move ahead. And so this is a book I would recommend. You know, we talked about, you know, the CFO or the COO moving up. This book teaches you how to act on in any meeting or one-on-one encounters if you're not good in a crowd. You know, D.A. Benton was a CEO coach, a CEO trainer, and a CEO consultant. And her book, I found, was very practical. And what was, you know, the time frame she wrote this in 92, there weren't very many women in the executive suite. She nailed this down perfectly. I mean, she has a section on how to properly shake hands. And it's more than just a firm handshake.
Yeah.
And she breaks it down how to make it a power move. How to walk down the office hallway, and it's more than just walking with a purpose. How to enter any room and establish immediate presence at the subconscious level. She has something called the 4-minute rule on self-control during meetings. And if you can hold it together for 4 minutes, you'll own the room.
You'll own the room.
And then the one I liked was how to effectively answer questions from the audience. You know, and who do you look at when you're answering the question? It's not the person that asks you the question, and she gives her reasons why. And so it's just a great book. And then the last book I would recommend, and it's by my favorite author, one of my favorite authors, Robert Greene. It's called The 48 Laws of Power.
That book I actually have. So the other two I'm going to have to get. But
yeah. Well, you know, I taught this at the Air War College. They selected me to teach one of the seminars on that. And so I said, you know, we have all these leadership books out there on how to inspire confidence and how to create a vision and how to do all this positive leadership stuff. 48 Laws of Power is not that book. If I put it into Star Wars terms, this is the dark arts.
The dark arts. Of leadership, right?
But I said it's important to understand those because, especially here in the D.C. area, people play power games with you all the time. And the book's important to learn how to recognize when people are employing those tactics on you and how to fight back or how to cope with those things. And so it's a great book that I enjoy. You don't have to read it cover to cover. You can skip around.
Yeah, you can jump to some of the different ones, that's for sure. I'm going to surprise you a little bit, but then again, if you've listened to the podcast, this might not surprise you. But the question I don't send anybody is, when you hear the word success, who is the first person that comes to mind?
Wow. Yeah, that is a good one. There are tons of people in our history that come to mind. I think it's dependent on what you want to do. And so, if I had to close my eyes and imagine someone right now with success, you got me, Randy. There are just so many good answers, for that. I mean, there were, military commanders that were good and at the top of their game and did things. Certainly some of the mentors that I mentioned before were in my definition of success. I'd say my parents were successful too. I mean, they raised 4 kids on a limited budget, everyone doing well. I look at my girls, they're succeeding as well.
Mom and parents, the answer that's been the most.
There's just lots of great examples living here in the United States that emulate that. I mean, I see examples, and you don't have to be a big success, in order to do that. I heard one time, I think it was one of the Maloof brothers, the owners of the Golden State Warrior and a whole bunch of other stuff. And he got asked a similar question. He said, if you could come back as someone, anyone in your life, who would it be? And he said, me. Hey, I come back as me. I thought, that's pretty profound, even though I'm not a billionaire.
Absolutely. This is the experience we have. The reason I love that question is because we all define success differently, right? So it's what does that mean to us? Tony, I want to thank you again for being on the show. The last question that I have for you is, do you have any final thoughts you'd like to share or asks of our listeners?
With our trade association and trying to get our brand out there, every credit union in the country, I believe, has a military connected a member or a family. And learning how to market to them, both while they're in the military or they become a veteran, we do good stuff. We help them understand the military life cycle and how to support these members. And so I would ask, come visit us at dcuc.org. Check out our organization. We're rolling out some new products. We have a Armed Forces Financial Guide that's hitting just at the right time as DOD's been mandated to have training at each stage in their career. doing a lot of stuff with technology, our advocacy and stuff. And so we're here to support all credit unions that support our military. And I would say, you know, come check us out. I think we have lots to offer.
You know what? We will link to all of that and then the different tools that you offer as well in the show notes. I know you're active on LinkedIn. Is that the best way if people have questions? A Twitter machine, email? What's your poison or preferred way for people to reach out if they have more questions of you?
Well, yeah, LinkedIn is great. My LinkedIn address is linkedin.com/in/AnthonyRHernandez1. And you can connect with me on that. Or you can email me at CEO@DCUC.org.
We will link to all those in the show notes. I, again, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day today. Tony, I hope you have an amazing day.
Thank you, Randy. It was a pleasure being here.
Before we go, I would once again like to thank Tony for taking the time out of his busy schedule. I had a blast having this conversation with him, and I look forward to our paths crossing out there and sharing a scotch. Also, a big thank you to our sponsor once again, Co-op Financial Services. Make sure to click on their link in the show notes to see everything they have going on. And if you're looking for your next book recommendation, check out the CU Insight Experience podcast book list, where you'll find every book that Tony mentioned and all the past guests all in one place with links over to Amazon for all the books mentioned. They'll be delivered to your door in a day or two. So happy reading. And once again, have a great day.